Disc 12. In early May, Washington asked Hamilton for his reflections on presidential etiquette. Like Adams, Hamilton thought the dignity of the office essential and recommended that Washington receive visitors at weekly levees, but not stay longer than a half hour and never return visits. He thought private dinners with legislators and other officials should be limited to 6 or 8 visitors, and that the president should not linger at the table. In a revealing suggestion, he also advised Washington to be available to senators, but not congressmen. Clearly, Hamilton wanted a president invested with a touch of grandeur and buffered from popular pressure. Washington generally took Hamilton's advice, holding levees on Tuesday afternoons that proved exercises in tedium. Even at the best of times, Washington was not a blithe presence, and the strict reception rules hardened him into a waxwork. He materialized in a black velvet coat, yellow gloves, and black satin breeches, with a dress sword hanging in a scabbard. Then he circulated among guests with glacial slowness, bowing but not shaking hands, exchanging pleasantries with each. Guests must have stifled yawns and fought off drowsiness. Bewigged footmen stood by at lavish dinners that couldn't have been fun either. The president seemed to bear in his countenance a settled aspect of melancholy, Senator William McClay of Pennsylvania wrote of one occasion. No cheering ray of convivial sunshine broke through the cloudy gloom of settled seriousness. At every interval of eating and drinking, he played on the table with a fork and knife, like a drumstick. Both as a matter of temperament and policy, Washington was taciturn, once advising his adopted grandson, "It is best to be silent, for there is nothing more certain than that it is at all times more easy to make enemies than friends." Such a circumspect president formed a striking contrast with the loquacious Hamilton. Washington tried to be neither too lofty nor too casual, and according to Abigail Adams, succeeded admirably that spring. He is polite with dignity, affable without formality, distant without haughtiness, grave without austerity, modest, wise, and good. Still, anti-federalists spied royal trappings galore, small but menacing concessions that portended a monarchy. When Washington rode out on public occasions through unpaved streets teeming with wandering pigs, he often traveled in a buff-colored coach with 2 liveried postillions to guide him. The coach was pulled by 6 white horses that had been rubbed with lustrous white paste. Their coats were brushed till they veritably gleamed in the dark. At the same time, to certify his Republican credentials, Washington took daily walks at 2 o'clock each afternoon. To modernize, the most incongruous fact of all was that Washington had 7 slaves shipped up from Mount Vernon to assist his white household servants. There might have been less hand-wringing over social distinctions had it not been for an obvious and widening gap between the rich and poor in New York. After years of wartime austerity, local merchants flaunted their wealth. Brissot de Warville observed, "If there is a town on the American continent where the English luxury displays its follies, it is New York. In the dress of the women, you will see the most brilliant silks, gauzes, hats, and borrowed hair. Equipages are rare, but they are elegant." Men of social distinction strode about in velvet coats and ruffled shirts, aping European nobility. For Republicans afraid that the country would slip back into aristocratic ways, such foppery smacked of old-world decadence. They worried that if the capital stayed in New York, American innocence would be undone by urban hedonism. Many legislators led confined, threadbare lives and did not partake of the extravagance. Ralph Izard complained that the poorly paid senators were forced into boarding houses, lodged in holes and corners, associated with improper company, and conversed improperly so as to lower their dignity and character, a situation that could have only heightened their resentment toward New York. Hamilton kept vigilant watch on the new Congress, aware that its early decisions were to affect profoundly American finance and the evolving structure of the executive and judiciary branches. Although scheduled to start in early March, the House and Senate took more than a month to muster quorums. In a significant piece of symbolism, the House met on the ground floor of Federal Hall and provided open galleries for visitors. At the inaugural session on April 1, 1789, Hamilton milled about among the onlookers. James Kent recalled, "Colonel Hamilton remarked to me that as nothing was to be done the first day, such impatient crowds were evidence of the powerful principle of curiosity." Meanwhile, the secretive Senate met upstairs in a chamber without a spectator section. For the first 5 years, senators conducted their business behind closed doors. The Constitution had kept a tactful silence about the executive departments of government and made no mention of a cabinet. For months after his inauguration, George Washington was the executive branch. The administration was still a nebulous concept, not a tangible reality. Madison lamented, "We are in a wilderness without a single footstep to guide us." The financial state of the new government was especially precarious. The United States had already suspended interest payments on much of its foreign and domestic debt, and American bonds continued to trade at steep discounts on European exchanges, suggesting little faith in the new government's ability to repay them. If this situation persisted, the government would have to pay extortionate interest rates to appease jittery creditors. Despite shrieking vendors, tinkling cowbells, and rumbling carts on Wall Street that often drowned out speakers inside Federal Hall, the new government slowly took shape during the summer and early fall. In the House, James Madison helped to compress dozens of changes to the Constitution recommended by the state conventions into 12 amendments. The first 10, when ratified by the states, would be known as the Bill of Rights. And in the Senate, Oliver Ellsworth took the lead in drafting a Judiciary Act that provided for a 6-member Supreme Court, buttressed by federal district and circuit courts. On May 19th, Representative Elias Boudinot of New Jersey, Hamilton's old patron from Elizabethtown, proposed that Congress establish a Department of Finance. From the clamor that arose over what would become the Treasury Department, it was clear this would be the real flashpoint of controversy in the new government, the place where critics feared that European-style despotism could take root. Legislators recalled that British tax abuses had spawned the revolution, and that chancellors of the Exchequer had directed huge armies of customs collectors to levy onerous duties. To guard against such concentrated power, Elbridge Gerry wanted to invest the Treasury leadership in a board, not an individual. It was Madison who insisted that a single secretary, equipped with all necessary powers, should superintend the department. A tremendous hubbub accompanied the act outlining the Treasury Secretary's duties, including his need to report to Congress on matters in his bailiwick. Opponents did not see this duty as a welcome form of congressional oversight that would subject the secretary to the bright glare of scrutiny. Mindful of British precedent, they feared it would open the door to executive tampering with legislative affairs, a charge that was, in fact, to hound Hamilton throughout his tenure. The spring of 1789 was a gratifying time for the patriotic Schuylers. Leaving behind her husband and 4 children, Angelica Church sailed from England and arrived in time to witness Washington's inauguration. She missed home terribly and was concerned about her gout-ridden father. Most of all, she yearned for the company of Alexander and Eliza. Hamilton remained smitten with his sister-in-law, never missing a chance to flatter or tease her with some arch message. With Angelica, he reverted to the high-spirited, chivalric young man. "I seldom write to a lady without fancying the relation of lover and mistress," he had told her after knocking off Federalist number 17. "It has a very inspiring effect, and in your case, the dullest materials could not help feeling that propensity." John Barker Church's political ambitions had subjected Angelica to a peculiarly uncomfortable fate. This daughter of an American general was about to become the wife of a member of the British Parliament. Trying to make the best of the situation, Angelica told Hamilton that she would happily have her husband in the House of Commons if he possessed your eloquence. Hamilton replied that he would rather have seen his brother-in-law elected to the new American Congress. Nevertheless, Church became an MP from Wendover Borough in 1790. At Down Place, their estate near Windsor Castle, the Churches surrounded themselves with luminous personalities from the literary, artistic, and political worlds. A visiting American cousin found the fashionable Angelica an angel, all affectionate politeness towards a cousin who trudges out to her country seat on foot. The churches inhabited a social world in which excessive drinking, compulsive gambling, and discreet adultery were routine. At the center of their circle stood the Prince of Wales, later King George IV, who adored Angelica, and Charles James Fox, the Whig leader, who shared John Church's gambling passion and often borrowed immense sums from him to feed his habit. The churches also kept a private box at the Drury Lane Theater and befriended the spendthrift playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan, author of The School for Scandal, who once refused to satisfy his creditors on the grounds that paying only encourages them. The churches also grew close to the American artist John Trumbull, lending him money so that he could study with Benjamin West in England and Jacques-Louis David in France. For all the glamorous settings, Angelica was often lonely and melancholy in her European exile. In one later plaintive letter to Eliza, she described going to the theater and beholding the royal family there, then added, "What are kings and queens to an American who has seen a Washington?" She went on to tell her sister, "I envy you the trio of agreeable men. You talk of my father and my Baron von Steuben and your Hamilton. What pleasant evenings, what agreeable chit-chat, whilst my society must be confined to chill, gloomy Englishmen." In another letter, heavy with homeward longing, Angelica wrote, "Adieu, my dear Eliza. Be happy and be gay, and remember me in your mirth as one who deserves and wishes to partake of your happiness. Embrace Hamilton and the Baron." It may be more than coincidental that the first scandalous reference to Hamilton's marital infidelity occurred in late March 1789, just as Angelica Church returned to New York. The town was humming with social events marking the new government, and the mutual admiration between Hamilton and his sister-in-law, apparent at parties and dinners they attended, must have excited speculation. At one ball, Angelica dropped a garter that was swept gallantly off the floor by Hamilton. Angelica, who had a sly wit, teased him that he wasn't a knight of the garter. Angelica's sarcastic sister Peggy then remarked, "He would be a knight of the bedchamber if he could." This may all have been harmless banter, but such tales fed material to the local gossips. Angelica stayed in New York till November, when she received a letter from John Church that some of their children had fallen sick. She promptly booked passage back to England. Whatever did or did not happen between Alexander and Angelica during her long stay in New York, Eliza was so distraught by her beloved sister's departure that she could not bear to see her off. She was consoled with difficulty by, among others, Baron von Steuben. Hamilton, his eldest son Philip, and the Baron escorted Angelica to the Battery and wistfully watched her vessel disappear from the harbor. The men gave way to extravagant emotions. "Imagine what we felt," Hamilton wrote to Angelica of this parting scene. "We gazed, we sighed, we wept." Even Steuben, hardened old warrior that he was, stood with tears brimming in his eyes. "Amiable Angelica," Hamilton concluded, "how much you are formed to endear yourself to every good heart. Some of us are and must continue inconsolable for your absence." Alexander and Eliza seemed united, not divided, by their shared adoration of Angelica. "Betsy and myself make you the last theme of our conversation at night and the first in the morning," Hamilton told her. Those gossips whose tongues wagged over the seeming flirtation of Alexander and Angelica might have been surprised to see Eliza's tender farewell note to her sister. "My very dear beloved Angelica, I have seated myself to write to you, but my heart is so saddened by your absence that it can scarcely dictate, my eyes so filled with tears that I shall not be able to write you much. But remember, remember, my dear sister, of the assurances of your returning to us, and do all you can to make your absence short. Tell Mr. Church for me of the happiness he will give me in bringing you to me, not to me alone, but to fond parents, sisters, friends, and to my Hamilton, who has for you all the affection of a fond own brother. I can no more. Adieu, adieu. E.H." As if to symbolize the tenuous state of the new administration, George Washington developed a queer affliction in mid-June 1789 that nearly killed him. What started out as a fever was followed by a tenderness in his left thigh that soon progressed to painful swelling and a malignant carbuncle. The president lost weight, could not sit up, and lay dangerously ill in bed for days. Few people outside the small presidential circle understood the extreme gravity of the illness, much less that it might prove fatal. Whether this was a product of anthrax, as diagnosed at the time, or a tumor, it was surgically excised without an anesthetic. In a still rural America, it was not uncommon for farmers and planters to contract anthrax from infected animals. The senior surgeon who presided over the procedure did so with seemingly sadistic gusto. "Cut away," he exclaimed. "Deep, deeper, deeper still. Don't be afraid. You will see how well he bears it." The president's health remained so uncertain that Mayor James Duane stopped carriages from passing Washington's residence and had straw spread on the sidewalk to muffle any sounds that might disturb him. As he convalesced, Washington lacked the strength to attend a 4th of July celebration conducted at St. Paul's Chapel by the Society of the Cincinnati. The ex-revolutionary officers foregathered at the city tavern, then headed for the church, attended by an artillery regiment and martial band. As they passed the presidential residence, Washington, decked out in full regimental regalia, greeted them from the doorway. Martha Washington then joined the officers at St. Paul's for the most glittering assemblage of personalities since the inauguration. Vice President Adams attended with the Senate and House of Representatives in tow. With eagles pinned to their buttonholes, the bemedaled Cincinnati members occupied their own special section. The highlight of the program was Hamilton's memorial oration for his friend, General Nathanael Greene, who had died 3 years earlier. One newspaper noted that a splendid assembly of ladies gazed down from the galleries, doubtless to Hamilton's delight. The clean, airy chapel sparkled with cut glass chandeliers and Corinthian columns, and was a superb, if slightly ironic, setting for the occasion. Speakers stood at a hooded pulpit topped by a coronet of six feathers, the last surviving emblem of British rule in the city. Hamilton had once paid homage to Greene by saying that he lacked nothing but an education to have made him the first man in the United States, and he now eulogized him with unfeigned affection. Like Hamilton, Greene had risen from modest circumstances and taught himself the science of warfare. At moments, Hamilton's panegyric had autobiographical overtones. It is an observation as just as it is common that in those great revolutions which occasionally convulse society, human nature never fails to be brought forward in its brightest as well as in its blackest colors. And it has very properly been ranked not among the least of the advantages which compensate for the evils they produce, that they serve to bring to light talents and virtues which might otherwise have languished in obscurity or only shot forth a few scattered and wandering rays. As commander of the Southern Army late in the Revolution, harassing Cornwallis, Greene had been renowned for performing wonders with often meager forces. Probably with this in mind, Hamilton committed the faux pas of openly mocking the state militia that had served under Greene. In recounting his exploits, Hamilton deprecated the militia as the mimicry of soldiership. As he told of fierce fighting in South Carolina, Hamilton said that front-line militia under Greene had buckled under fire and were rescued by a second line of brave, resolute Continentals. Hamilton probably had scant notion that his passing comment on South Carolina's militia had mortally offended a congressman from that state, Edanus Burke, a bibulous, hot-tempered Irishman. At the time, Hamilton was not a federal official, and Burke did not make an open issue of the speech. Moreover, after the New York ratifying convention, Hamilton stood at the peak of his popularity, and Burke did not dare to challenge him. He later explained, "Mr. Hamilton was the hero of the day and the favorite of the people. And had I hurt a hair of his head, I'm sure I should have been dragged through the kennels of New York and pitched headlong into the East River." As we shall see, Burke stewed about the episode and awaited a strategic moment to retaliate. He and other Southerners perhaps also took umbrage at Hamilton's frank statement that patriotic operations in the South had been hampered by a numerous body of slaves bound by all the laws of injured humanity to hate their masters. Hamilton was admitting that masters deserved to be hated by their slaves and had behaved logically in sympathizing with the British or failing to cooperate with the Patriots. sentiments that surely were anathema to the slaveholders. Hamilton seemed to spark controversy at every turn. At the time of his July 4th oration, New York still had not selected its first two senators. Under the Constitution, this decision fell to state legislatures, ensuring that local mandarins would have a disproportionate say in the matter. As in the colonial period, New York politics was still largely governed by a few powerful families. In the felicitous words of one early Burr biographer, the Clintons had power, the Livingstons had numbers, and the Schuylers had Hamilton. As chieftain of his clan, General Philip Schuyler was a certain choice for one senatorial post. One of Schuyler's other sons-in-law, the super-rich Stephen Van Rensselaer, was elected to the New York Assembly that year. Schuyler promised the rival Livingstons that he would support New York Mayor James Duane, who had married into their family, for the other Senate seat. Had this alliance held, the Schuylers and the Livingstons might have shared power in New York and isolated George Clinton. They might even have thwarted the later Jeffersonian incursion into the state and altered the entire configuration of American politics. This scenario never materialized, however, because Hamilton stumbled into a spectacular political blunder. Afraid that Duane's successor as mayor might be some very unfit character whose politics would prove injurious to the city, Hamilton decided to oppose him for the second Senate seat. In a blatant affront to the almighty Livingstons, Hamilton threw his weight behind his 34-year-old friend Rufus King, a handsome, Harvard-educated lawyer from New England who had recently moved to New York. King had married a beautiful heiress, Mary Alsop, and the two socialized with the Hamiltons. A mellifluous orator and an impassioned critic of slavery, King had attended the Constitutional Convention as a Massachusetts delegate and served on the Style Committee with Hamilton. In a short period of time, King became a fixture in New York City society. Our King is as much followed and attended to by all parties as ever a new light preacher was by his congregation, Robert Troup told Hamilton. And Hamilton induced Philip Schuyler to renege on his pledged support for Duane in favor of King. In a foolish and egotistical move, Hamilton was bent upon having both his father-in-law and his friend as New York's two senators. With finely honed political instincts, George Clinton saw that Hamilton was overreaching, and he secretly aided King's candidacy in order to drive a wedge between the Schuylers and the Livingstons. When New York picked its second senator on July 16, 1789, Rufus King came out on top. Just as Clinton suspected, Chancellor Robert R. Livingston was irate and gradually moved into the governor's camp. The polished, graceful Livingston was accustomed to deference and felt stymied by the parvenu Hamilton. This weakened Hamilton in his home state, depriving him later of a vital springboard to the presidency. It also paved the way for Aaron Burr to work his peculiar mischief in state politics. Compounding the tension between Hamilton and Robert R. Livingston that summer was that both men had fixed their gaze on the same tantalizing prize, the job of Treasury Secretary, soon to be assigned by Washington and sure to be the most powerful spot in the first administration. As George Washington mulled over his choice, he knew that fiscal bungling had led to the demise of the Confederation, making this a critical appointment. He turned first to the man synonymous with patriotic finance, Robert Morris, the Philadelphia merchant who had pledged his personal credit on behalf of the Revolution. Washington's adopted grandson said that en route to the inauguration in April, the president-elect had stopped at Morris's opulent residence. "The Treasury, Morris, will of course be your berth," Washington confided. "After your invaluable services as financier of the Revolution, no one can pretend to contest the office of the Secretary of the Treasury with you." Citing private reasons, Morris was already lurching down a long, slippery path that led to bankruptcy and debtor's prison. Morris politely declined the offer. "But, my dear general," he reassured Washington, "you will be no loser by my declining the secretaryship of the Treasury, for I can recommend to you a far cleverer fellow than I am for your Minister of Finance in the person of your former aide-de-camp, Colonel Hamilton." Taken aback, Washington replied, "I always knew Colonel Hamilton to be a man of superior talents, but never supposed that he had any knowledge of finance." He knows everything, sir, Morris replied. To a mind like his, nothing comes amiss. Another version of the story has Washington asking Morris what to do about the huge pile of public debt. Morris advised, there is but one man in the United States who can tell you. That is Alexander Hamilton. Robert Morris served in the first U.S. Senate instead. Even as Washington conferred with Morris, Hamilton was strolling down a New York street when he encountered Alexander J. Dallas, a Philadelphia lawyer. Well, Colonel, can you tell me who will be the members of the cabinet? Dallas asked. Really, my dear sir, Hamilton answered, I cannot tell you who will, but I can very readily tell you of one who will not be of the number, and that one is your humble servant. Soon after being sworn in as president, Washington informed Hamilton that he planned to name him to the top financial spot. Hamilton must have daydreamed about this moment for years. Why else had he plowed through dry economic texts during the war or perused the three-volume memoir of Jacques Necker, the French finance minister? For years, his mind had wrought detailed financial plans, as if he were rehearsing for the job. His ascent to the Treasury post seemed an almost inevitable next step in his headlong rush to fame. Clearly, he felt equal to the task and told Washington that he would accept if offered. Friends cautioned him against heading the Treasury Department, the activities of which would arouse latent memories of British rule. When Governor Morris assured him that the Treasury Secretary would be exposed to special calumny, Hamilton replied that it is the situation in which I can do the most good. In debating the Constitution, Hamilton knew that the issue of federal taxation and tax collectors had provoked the biggest brouhaha. As chief tax collector, he would be the lightning rod for inevitable discontent. In fact, everything that Hamilton planned to create to transform America into a powerful, modern nation-state, a central bank, a funded debt, a mint, a customs service, manufacturing subsidies, and so on, was to strike critics as a slavish imitation of the British model. After chatting with Washington, Hamilton informed Robert Troop of the momentous news and asked if he would assume his legal business. Troop was glad to oblige, but thought Hamilton was committing a serious error. He noted the financial sacrifice entailed by the annual salary of $3,500, far less than Hamilton was then earning as a lawyer. Troop recalled he remonstrated with Hamilton on the ground of the serious injury his quitting the practice of the law would work to his family. At that time, Hamilton's fortune was very limited and his family was increasing. Hamilton told Troop that he understood the financial sacrifice, but he thought it would be in his power in the financial department of the government to do the country great good, and this consideration outweighed with him every consideration of a private nature. A man of irreproachable integrity, Hamilton severed all outside sources of income while in office, something that neither Washington nor Jefferson nor Madison dared to do. Later on, Hamilton acknowledged that the Treasury job was the logical culmination of his long campaign for the Constitution. Having been part of the system's gestation, I conceived myself to be under an obligation to lend my aid towards putting the machine in some regular motion. Hence, I did not hesitate to accept the offer of President Washington to undertake the office of Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton kept his appointment secret from all but a few friends, while rivals maneuvered for the post. In late May, Madison told Jefferson that Robert R. Livingston coveted the Treasury job, but that Hamilton was perhaps best qualified for that species of business and stood a better chance. After losing the Treasury job, Livingston lobbied to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and lost that battle to John Jay. When he added in his family's loss of the New York Senate seat, Livingston must have believed that Hamilton and Schuyler, if not the entire Washington administration, were unalterably hostile to his ambitions. In July, Hamilton recommended to Washington that Livingston be sent to negotiate a European loan, but this olive branch did not heal the breach between the two men. Throughout the summer, as word spread that Hamilton's appointment was imminent, it caused a flurry of excitement among admirers in New England and elsewhere. But the official announcement was deferred until Washington signed the bill creating the Treasury Department on September 2nd. Then, on Friday, September 11th, 1789, 34-year-old Alexander Hamilton was officially nominated for the job. The appointment was confirmed by the Senate the same day. Hamilton hit the ground running. The very next day, he arranged a $50,000 loan for the federal government from the Bank of New York. The day after that, a Sunday, he worked all day at the Treasury's new office on Broadway, just south of Trinity Church. He dashed off a plea to the Bank of North America in Philadelphia, asking for another $50,000. Hamilton knew the symbolic value of rapid decision-making and phenomenal energy. As he wrote during the Revolution, "If a government appears to be confident of its own powers, it is the surest way to inspire the same confidence in others." With support for the Constitution still tentative in some states, Hamilton knew that designing enemies lay in wait to destroy it. To succeed, the government had to establish its authority, and to this end, he was prepared to move with exceptional speed. Alexander Hamilton never seemed to wander around in a normal human muddle. With preternatural confidence, he discerned clear solutions to the murkiest questions. From the beginning, he faced pressure as wary creditors waited to see if the young Treasury Secretary could miraculously resurrect American credit. Only 10 days after Hamilton was confirmed, the House of Representatives asked him to prepare a report on public credit, giving him a scant 110 days to respond. With this wind at his back, Hamilton took a giant running leap in staking out his claim to leadership in Washington's administration. No other moment in American history could have allowed such scope for Hamilton's abundant talents. The new government was a tabula rasa on which he could sketch plans with a young man's energy. Washington's administration had to create everything from scratch. Hamilton was that rare revolutionary, a master administrator and as competent a public servant as American politics would ever produce. One historian has written, "Hamilton was an administrative genius who assumed an influence in Washington's cabinet which is unmatched in the annals of the American cabinet system." The position demanded both a thinker and a doer, a skilled executive and a political theorist, a system builder who could devise interrelated policies. It also demanded someone who could build an institutional framework consistent with constitutional principles. Virtually every program that Hamilton put together raised fundamental constitutional issues, so that his legal training and work on the Federalist enabled him to craft the efficient machinery of government while expounding its theoretical underpinnings. Because the Constitution made no mention of a cabinet, Washington had to invent it. At first, this executive council consisted of just 3 men: Hamilton as Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson as Secretary of State, and Henry Knox as Secretary of War. The first Attorney General, 36-year-old Edmund Randolph of Virginia, had no department and received an annual retainer of $1,500 for an essentially consultative role. Viewed as the government's legal advisor, the tall, handsome Randolph was expected to retain private clients to supplement his modest salary. Vice President John Adams was largely excluded from the administration's decision-making apparatus, a demotion in power that could only have sharpened his envy of young Hamilton. The concept of a cabinet took some time to mature. During his first 3 years as president, Washington seldom assembled his secretaries for meetings. As Hamilton later told the British minister, "We have no cabinet, and the heads of departments meet on very particular occasions only," and preferred to solicit their views separately. With only 3 executive departments, each secretary wielded considerable power. Moreover, departmental boundaries were not well defined, allowing each secretary to roam across a wide spectrum of issues. This was encouraged by Washington, who frequently requested opinions from his entire cabinet on an issue. It particularly galled Jefferson that Hamilton, with his keen appetite for power, poached so frequently on his turf. In fact, Hamilton's opinions were so numerous and his influence so pervasive that most historians regard him as having been something akin to a prime minister. If Washington was head of state, then Hamilton was the head of government, the active force in the administration. As in the Revolution, Hamilton and Washington had complementary talents. Neither could have achieved alone what they did together. Sometimes emphasizing the ceremonial side of his job, Washington wanted to be a figure above the partisan fray, retaining his aura as an embodiment of the Revolution. His detached style left room for an assertive managerial presence, especially in financial matters, where Hamilton stepped willingly into the breach. If Washington lacked the first-rate intellect of Hamilton, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, and Adams, he was gifted with superb judgment. When presented with options, he almost invariably chose the right one. Never a pliant tool in Hamilton's hands, as critics alleged, he often overrode his Treasury Secretary. Washington and Hamilton also made an exceptional team because they offset each other's personal weaknesses. Washington could be hypersensitive to criticism and never forgot snubs. But he had learned to govern his emotions, making him a valuable foil to the volatile Hamilton. Hamilton could be needlessly tactless and provocative, while Washington was conciliatory, with an innate sense of decorum. Adams said that Washington possessed the gift of taciturnity. Hamilton's mind was so swift and decisive that it could lead him into rash decisions. Washington's management style was the antithesis of this. He consulted much, pondered much, resolved slowly, resolved surely, Hamilton later said of the president. Washington could weigh all sides of an issue and coolly appraise the political repercussions. Perhaps the strongest feature in his character was prudence, never acting until every circumstance, every consideration was maturely weighed, refraining if he saw a doubt, but, when once decided, going through with his purpose whatever obstacles opposed, said Jefferson. Such a man could be counted on to temper his Treasury Secretary's excesses. Perhaps the main reason that Washington and Hamilton functioned so well together was that both men longed to see the 13 states welded into a single, respected American nation. At the close of the war, Washington had circulated a letter to the 13 governors, outlining four things America would need to attain greatness: consolidation of the states under a strong federal government, timely payment of its debts, creation of an army and navy, and harmony among its people. Hamilton would have written the identical list. The young Treasury Secretary gained incomparable power under Washington because the president approved of the agenda that he promoted with such tireless brilliance. Jefferson had it wrong when he charged that Hamilton manipulated Washington. On fundamental political matters, Washington was simply more attuned to Hamilton than he was to Jefferson. For that reason, Washington willingly served as the political shield that Alexander Hamilton needed as he became America's most influential and controversial man. Chapter 15. Villainous Business. As Alexander Hamilton began to stitch together his grand plan for a vigorous central government, the executive branch was still tiny and embryonic. On his first day at Treasury, Hamilton likely wandered through a set of empty rooms and soon installed an elegant mahogany desk with caryatids, female figures, carved into its spindly legs. He was to perform an amazing amount of work on that desktop. Hamilton employed no ghostwriters for his countless speeches, articles, and reports, and almost all of his letters have come down to posterity in his own hand. As master of Mount Vernon, George Washington presided over a larger staff than he did as president. From the outset, Hamilton supervised the biggest department, which soon had 39 employees, compared to 5 for state, generating instant fears that he was building a large bureaucracy as his personal power base. The pace at Treasury was positively torrid compared to that at war. When Henry Knox arrived in New York City and took up his official duties, notes biographer North Callahan, he found little to do at first but become acquainted with his one secretary and one clerk, who at that time constituted the entire personnel of the War Department. As the first Treasury Secretary, Hamilton had to devise rudimentary systems for bookkeeping, checking, and auditing, many of which endured for generations. Hamilton threw himself into the most mundane tasks, as if glorying in the managerial challenge. To pedestrians passing him in the street, the Treasury Secretary could seem an aloof, cerebral man, shut up inside his thoughts, seldom making eye contact with strangers. One New York newspaper joked that anyone hoping to be Treasury Secretary should appear in the streets but seldom, and then let him take care to look down on the pavement, as if lost in thought profound. Few intervals of leisure relieved the work pressure of these first months. After Angelica left for England, Eliza and the children retreated to Albany, leaving Hamilton alone in New York, trapped beneath piles of work. "I am a solitary, lost being without you all," he wrote to Eliza, "and shall with increasing anxiety look forward to our reunion." When Eliza returned later in the month, she and Alexander had the thrilling experience of going with George and Martha Washington to the John Street Theater to see Richard Brinsley Sheridan's comedy, The Critic. As the politicians entered, the orchestra struck up the President's March, and the audience gave them a standing ovation. Eliza always remembered with amusement another time when a Miss McEvers showed up at one of Martha Washington's receptions, sporting an enormous headdress of ostrich feathers. When this fashion accessory caught fire from the chandelier, Major William Jackson, then an aide to the president, leaped to her side and extinguished the blaze by clapping the feathers between his hands. Such outings were rare during Hamilton's harried first days in office. He had to create a customs service on the spot, for customs duties were to be the main source of government revenue. During his second day in office, he issued a circular to all customs collectors, demanding exact figures of the duties accumulated in each state. When they sent back suspiciously low numbers, Hamilton, who knew something about smuggling from St. Croix, suspected that it must be rife along the eastern seaboard, leading him to the next logical step. "I have under consideration the business of establishing guard boats," he told one correspondent in perhaps the first recorded allusion to what would turn into the Coast Guard. Hamilton's appetite for information was bottomless. To his port wardens, he made minute inquiries about their lighthouses, beacons, and buoys. He asked customs collectors for ship manifests so he could ascertain the exact quantity and nature of cargo being exported. The whole statistical basis of government took shape under his command. In a significant decision, he decided that customs revenues could be paid not just in gold and silver, but with notes from the Bank of New York and the Bank of North America, an innovation that began to steer the country away from use of coins and toward an efficient system of paper money. Hamilton had always been punctual. "I hate procrastination in business," he once said, and lost no time assembling a first-rate staff imbued with a sense of public service. On the day he was nominated, five assistants, including Auditor Oliver Wolcott Jr. of Connecticut, were confirmed as well. When Samuel Meredith of Pennsylvania was appointed treasurer, the hard-driving secretary lectured him, "I need not observe to you how important it is that you should be on the ground as speedily as possible." For his first assistant secretary, Hamilton picked his witty, elegant, vivacious friend William Dewar, who had married Lord Stirling's daughter, Lady Kitty. The choice of Dewar was to have grievous consequences for Hamilton, for he was an inveterate speculator, and his later scandals besmirched Hamilton's reputation. Dewar had grown up in England and studied classics at Eton. After his father's death, he worked as a teenager for the East India Company in Bengal, where the climate injured his health. After spending time on a family plantation in Antigua, he bought land in upstate New York, not far from the Schuyler property in Saratoga, and sold lumber to the British Navy. Because he had befriended Miles Cooper in England, Dewar came to know Hamilton while he was still studying at King's College. The association with Dewar became so supremely damaging to Hamilton that it later mystified many friends. But the two men were compatible in their political opinions and ebullient style, and Dewar's resume amply qualified him for the job. While still in England, he had been an outspoken Whig who championed the colonists' grievances and plumped for reforms to avert a revolt. During the Revolution, he supplied goods to the Continental Army, served in the Continental Congress, and attended the convention that drafted the New York State Constitution. He was smart enough that Hamilton had recruited him to write essays for the Federalist, only to reject his two submissions. At the time Hamilton picked him, Dewar had just completed 3 years as secretary to the old Board of Treasury. In 1789, Hamilton cajoled him into staying on by creating the assistant secretary post expressly for him. Unfortunately, William Dewar suffered from a severe case of moral myopia and always found rather blurry the line between public service and private gain. That autumn, Hamilton was about to make decisions that would drastically affect the value of outstanding government securities, so that secrecy and integrity were obligatory among his colleagues. It later turned out that Dewar had been assembling a huge stake in government securities for several years. Among other faults, the indiscreet Dewar babbled to his cronies about Hamilton's scheme for funding government debt, the sort of priceless insider gossip that moves markets. Just a week after Hamilton took office, Noah Webster sent to a speculator in Amsterdam secret details of the Treasury Secretary's funding scheme, attributing them to the outdoor talk of Colonel Dewar, the Vice Secretary. Senator William McLay, a tireless, if dyspeptic, diarist, recorded rumors of congressmen speculating in state debt and said that nobody doubts but all commotion originated from the Treasury. But the fault is laid on Dewar. Unfortunately, Dewar's actions fed unjust scuttlebutt that the new Treasury Department was a sink of corruption. In reality, as soon as he took office, Hamilton established high ethical standards and promulgated a policy that employees could not deal in government securities, setting a critical precedent for America's civil service. Hamilton divested himself of any business investments that might create conflicts of interest. Even later, as a private citizen, he said that his own scrupulousness had prevented him from being concerned in what is termed speculation. This made his blindness to Dewar's shameless machinations the more bewildering. Hamilton was an extremely perceptive judge of character, and William Dewar was one of the few cases in which his acute vision seems to have been blinkered. Because Jefferson had not yet arrived in New York to take up his duties as Secretary of State, Hamilton was not shy about acting as his surrogate. A British diplomat named Major George Beckwith, an aide to the Governor General of Canada, sounded out Philip Schuyler about an unofficial meeting with the new Treasury Secretary. Hamilton's pro-British proclivities were well known. When Hamilton met secretly with Beckwith in October, they had to proceed cautiously since Britain still lacked an official diplomatic presence in America. So the discussion qualified as unofficial, although Hamilton reassured Beckwith that his words reflected the sentiments of the most enlightened men in this country. They are those of General Washington, I can confidently assure you, as well as of a great majority in the Senate. For security reasons, Beckwith assigned Hamilton the code number 7 in reporting their talks back to London, a precaution that later led to preposterous charges that Hamilton was a British agent. In fact, Washington knew about some of these clandestine talks and received summaries from Hamilton. In his wide-ranging chats with Beckwith, Hamilton touched upon the prospect of a commercial treaty with England and left little doubt about his sympathies. "I have always preferred a connection with you to that of any other country. We think in English and have a similarity of prejudices and of predilections." He shared Beckwith's chagrin over proposals that Madison had submitted to Congress to discriminate against British shipping. "The truth is," Hamilton confided of Madison, "that although this gentleman is a clever man, he is very little acquainted with the world. That he is uncorrupted and incorruptible, I have not a doubt." Hamilton's projected vision of a commercial alliance between American and British commerce, far from being fawning, was laced with subtle threats and enticements. With his premonition of future American greatness, he made clear that Britain should reckon with American purchasing power. "I do think we are and shall be great consumers." He foresaw that America, if now junior to Britain in status, would someday rival her as an economic power. "We are a young and growing empire with much enterprise and vigor, but undoubtedly are, and must be for years, rather an agricultural than a manufacturing people." As a raw materials producer, Hamilton noted, the United States currently formed a perfect fit with England, the manufacturing colossus. On the other hand, the northern states were making headway in manufacturing, and if Britain thwarted America, such threats to Britain's dominance would grow apace. If spurned by England, the United States could also forge an alliance with France that would threaten British possessions in the West Indies. Far from being a pro-British lackey, much less a high-level spy, Hamilton stubbornly defended U.S. interests at every turn. He was bargaining with Beckwith, not groveling. He insisted that the United States should be able to trade with the British West Indies. He wanted England to heed the peace treaty and relinquish its western forts in the Ohio Valley. The one place where Hamilton deviated from official policy was in applauding Britain's refusal to hand over slaves who had defected during the Revolution. To have given up these men to their masters after the assurances of protection held out to them was impossible, Hamilton told Beckwith. At the end of their talk, Hamilton hinted that the United States would soon send an emissary to England to continue talks about the matters discussed. On October 7th, Washington discussed such an appointment with Hamilton and Jay and accepted Hamilton's suggestion that Governor Morris go to England. Within weeks of his confirmation as Treasury Secretary, Hamilton had already staked out a position as the administration's most influential figure on foreign policy. That Hamilton had time to worry about foreign policy is a wonder. The meeting with Beckwith was a fleeting respite from the giant task that engrossed him that fall. The report on public credit that Congress wanted by January. He had to sum up America's financial predicament and recommend corrective measures to deal with the enormous public debt left over from the Revolution. Hamilton solicited opinions, but his report was not the product of a committee. As with his 51 Federalist essays, he put in another sustained bout of solitary, Herculean labor. Closeted in his study day after day, he scratched out a 40,000-word treatise, a short book, in slightly more than 3 months, performing all the complex mathematical calculations himself. While other members of the revolutionary generation dreamed of an American Eden, Hamilton continued to ransack British and French history for ideas. He had inordinate admiration for Jacques Necker, the French finance minister, who had argued that government borrowing could strengthen military prowess, but it was England that shone as Hamilton's true lodestar in public finance. Back in the 1690s, the British had set up the Bank of England, enacted an excise tax on spirits, and funded its public debt, that is, pledged specific revenues to ensure repayment of its debt. During the 18th century, it had vastly expanded that public debt. Far from weakening the country, it had produced manifold benefits. Public credit had enabled England to build up the Royal Navy, to prosecute wars around the world, to maintain a global commercial empire. At the same time, government bonds issued to pay for the debt galvanized the economy, since creditors could use them as collateral for loans. By imitating British practice, Hamilton did not intend to make America subservient to the former mother country, as critics claimed. His objective was to promote American prosperity and self-sufficiency and make the country ultimately less reliant on British capital. Hamilton wanted to use British methods to defeat Britain economically. In preparing his report, Hamilton was eclectic in his sources. He had clearly plumbed David Hume's political discourses, which admitted that public debt could vitalize business activity. Montesquieu had stressed that states should honor financial obligations, as a breach in the public faith cannot be made on a certain number of subjects without seeming to be made on all. Thomas Hobbes had emphasized the sacredness of contracts in transfers of securities, arguing that people entered into such transactions voluntarily and must accept all the consequences, a seemingly arcane point that shortly had explosive consequences for Hamilton's career. During the Revolution, Hamilton had stuffed Malachy Postlethwaite's Universal Dictionary of Trade and Commerce into his satchel, and now he used it once again. Postlethwaite stressed that no country could borrow money at attractive interest rates unless creditors could freely buy and sell its bonds. Such is the nature of public credit that nobody would lend their money to the support of the state under the most pressing emergencies unless they could have the privilege of buying and selling their property in the public funds when their occasions required. Inviolable property rights lay at the heart of the capitalist culture that Hamilton wished to enshrine in America. As he toiled over the report, Hamilton queried several contemporaries, including John Witherspoon, the Princeton president who had rebuffed his request for accelerated study. Hamilton must have been amused by the educator's deferential reply. "It is very flattering to me that you suppose I can render any assistance by advice in the important duties of your present station." Aware that the American Revolution had produced a nation averse to taxes, Hamilton asked Madison, "What further taxes will be least unpopular?" At this point, Hamilton and Madison still shared a sense of political camaraderie. One lady remembered seeing them together that summer turn and laugh and play with a monkey that was climbing in a neighbor's yard. But the letter that Madison now wrote to Hamilton gave the first preview of a fateful schism between them. Madison did not want a long-term government debt, fearing that such securities would fall into foreign hands. As they have more money than the Americans and less productive ways of laying it out, they can and will pretty generally buy out the Americans. When Madison registered this muted dissent, Hamilton had no idea that such differences of opinion were soon to demolish their friendship. Had Hamilton stuck to dry financial matters, his report on public credit would never have attained such historic renown. Instead, he presented a detailed blueprint of the government's fiscal machinery, wrapped in a broad political and economic vision. From the opening pages, Hamilton reminded readers that the government's debt was the price of liberty inherited from the Revolution and had special claims on the public purse. The states had balked at taxing citizens during a revolt against onerous taxes, and Congress had lacked the power to levy taxes, leaving borrowing as the only solution. The outstanding debt was now enormous, $54 million in national debt, coupled with $25 million in state debt for a total of $79 million. Hamilton argued that the security of liberty and property were inseparable and that governments should honor their debts because contracts formed the basis of public and private morality. States, like individuals who observe their engagements, are respected and trusted, while the reverse is the fate of those who pursue an opposite conduct. The proper handling of government debt would permit America to borrow at affordable interest rates and would also act as a tonic to the economy. Used as loan collateral, government bonds could function as money. And it was the scarcity of money, Hamilton observed, that had crippled the economy and resulted in severe deflation in the value of land. America was a young country rich in opportunity. It lacked only liquid capital, and government debt could supply that gaping deficiency. The secret of managing government debt was to fund it properly by setting aside revenues at regular intervals to service interest and pay off principal. Hamilton refuted charges that his funding scheme would feed speculation. Quite the contrary. If investors knew for sure that government bonds would be paid off, the prices would not fluctuate wildly, depriving speculators of opportunities to exploit. What mattered was that people trusted the government to make good on repayment. In nothing are appearances of greater moment than in whatever regards credit. Opinion is the soul of it, and this is affected by appearances as well as realities. Hamilton intuited that public relations and confidence building were to be the special burdens of every future Treasury Secretary. How exactly the debt should be funded was to be the most inflammatory political issue. During the Revolution, many affluent citizens had invested in bonds, and many war veterans had been paid with IOUs that then plummeted in price under the Confederation. In many cases, these upright patriots, either needing cash or convinced they would never be repaid, had sold their securities to speculators for as little as 15 cents on the dollar. Under the influence of his funding scheme, with government repayment guaranteed, Hamilton expected these bonds to soar from their depressed levels and regain their full face value. This pleasing prospect, however, presented a political quandary. If the bonds appreciated, should speculators pocket the windfall? Or should the money go to the original holders, many of them brave soldiers, who had sold their depressed government paper years earlier? The answer to this perplexing question, Hamilton knew, would define the future character of American capital markets. Doubtless, taking a deep breath, he wrote that after the most mature reflection about whether to reward original holders and punish current speculators, he had decided against this approach as ruinous to public credit. The problem was partly that such discrimination in favor of former debt holders was unworkable. The government would have to track them down, ascertain their sale prices, then trace all intermediate investors who had held the debt before it was bought by the current owners. An administrative nightmare. Hamilton could have left it at that, ducking the political issue and taking refuge in technical jargon. Instead, he shifted the terms of the debate. He said that the first holders were not simply noble victims, nor were the current buyers simply predatory speculators. The original investors had gotten cash when they wanted it and had shown little faith in the country's future. Speculators, meanwhile, had hazarded their money and should be rewarded for the risk. In this manner, Hamilton stole the moral high ground from opponents and established the legal and moral basis for securities trading in America. The notion that securities are freely transferable and that buyers assume all rights to profit or loss in transactions. The knowledge that government could not interfere retroactively with a financial transaction was so vital, Hamilton thought, as to outweigh any short-term expediency. To establish the concept of the security of transfer, Hamilton was willing, if necessary, to reward mercenary scoundrels and penalize patriotic citizens. With this huge gamble, Hamilton laid the foundations for America's future financial preeminence. As his report progressed, Hamilton tiptoed through a field seeded thickly with deadly political traps. The next incendiary issue was that some debt was owed by the 13 states, some by the federal government. Hamilton decided to consolidate all the debt into a single form, federal debt. He wrote, "The Secretary, after mature reflection on this point, entertains a full conviction that an assumption of the debts of the particular states by the Union, and a like provision for them as for those of the Union, will be a measure of sound policy and substantial justice." The repercussions of this decision were as pervasive as anything Alexander Hamilton ever did to fortify the U.S. government. Why was this assumption of state debts by the federal government so crucial? For starters, it would be more efficient, since there would be one overarching scheme for settling debt instead of many small competing schemes. It also reflected a profound political logic. Hamilton knew that bondholders would feel a stake in preserving any government that owed them money. If the federal government, not the states, was owed the money, creditors would shift their main allegiance to the central government. Hamilton's interest was not in enriching creditors or cultivating the privileged class, so much as in ensuring the government's stability and survival. Walter Lippmann later said of Hamilton, "He used the rich for a purpose that was greater than their riches." On the other hand, he was naive in thinking that the rich would always have a broader sense of public duty and would somehow be devoid of self-interest, instead of being captives to an even larger set of interests. There was a further advantage to the assumption of state debt. The Constitution had granted the federal government an exclusive right to collect import duties. If states had to pay off debts, too, they might contest that monopoly and try to skim off money from their import duties, recreating the chaos under the Articles of Confederation. Under his scheme, Hamilton believed, the states would lose incentive to compete with the federal government for major revenue sources. Hamilton now had to decide whether state debt should be paid off at the original interest rates. He knew this would be impossible to accomplish without stiff taxes, which might precipitate a rebellion or impoverish the country. He also did not want to give too bountiful a reward to speculators who had rounded up state debt at cheap prices from small investors. So he decided that foreign debt, which bore interest rates of only 4 or 5%, was to be paid in full. Domestic debt, with a 6% interest rate, posed a greater dilemma. To relieve financial pressure on the government, Hamilton decided on a partial repudiation of the domestic debt, though he certainly did not phrase it that way. He gambled that creditors would accept lower interest rates in exchange for rock-solid securities that could not be redeemed by government if interest rates fell. In modern parlance, non-callable bonds. To entice domestic creditors, he offered a long list of voluntary options, only some of which were enacted. They could receive, for instance, part of their payment at the original 6% interest rate and part in Western land, enabling them to participate in the appreciation of frontier property. Or they could take payment at a lower interest rate but stretched over a longer period. To enhance such choices, investors would be paid quarterly, not annually. Most significantly, creditors would be paid with taxes pledged for that express purpose. Hamilton's supporters praised the Byzantine brilliance of this program. For his foes, it smacked of impenetrable mumbo-jumbo, designed to hoodwink the public. To make good on payments, Hamilton knew he would have to raise a substantial loan abroad and boost domestic taxes beyond the import duties now at his disposal. He proposed taxes on wines and spirits distilled within the United States, as well as on tea and coffee. Of these first sin taxes, the secretary observed that the products taxed are all of them in reality luxuries, the greatest part of them foreign luxuries. Some of them, in the excess in which they are used, pernicious luxuries. Such taxation might dampen consumption and reduce revenues, Hamilton acknowledged, but he doubted this would happen because luxuries of every kind lay the strongest hold on the attachments of mankind, which, especially when confirmed by habit, are not easily alienated from them. In the report's final section, Hamilton reiterated that a well-funded debt would be a national blessing that would protect American prosperity. He feared this statement would be misconstrued as a call for a perpetual public debt, and that is exactly what happened. For the rest of his life, he was to express dismay at what he saw as a deliberate distortion of his views. His opponents, he claimed, neglected a critical passage of his report in which he wrote that he ardently wishes to see it incorporated as a fundamental maxim in the system of public credit of the United States that the creation of debt should always be accompanied with the means of extinguishment. The secretary regarded this as the true secret for rendering public credit immortal. 3 years later, Hamilton testily reminded the public that he had advocated extinguishing the debt in the very first communication which he ever made on the subject of the public debt, in that very report which contains the expressions now tortured into an advocation of the doctrine that public debts are public blessings. Indeed, in Hamilton's writings, his warnings about oppressive debt vastly outnumber his paeans to public debt as a source of liquid capital. 5 years after his first report, still fuming, he warned that progressive accumulation of debt is perhaps the natural disease of all governments, and it is not easy to conceive anything more likely than this to lead to great and convulsive revolutions of empire. To make sure the debt was extinguished over time, Hamilton proposed the creation of a sinking fund, financed by post office revenues and manned by the government's chief officers. A sinking fund is a repository set up apart from the general budget for revenues to pay off debt. It would sequester revenues from the sudden whims of grasping politicians who might want to raid the treasury for short-term gain. The sinking fund would retire about 5% of the debt each year until it was paid off. Because outstanding bonds currently traded below their original face value, such purchases would benefit the government as the securities rose in price. Thus, the government would profit from rising prices alongside private investors. Hamilton concluded, in the opinion of the secretary, it ought to be the policy of the government to raise the value of stock to its true standard as fast as possible. Little did he know how quickly he was to succeed, or how much trouble this success was to bring in its wake. Even as Hamilton compiled this magnum opus, the prices of government securities streaked upward in anticipation of its publication, the psychological effect being even more pronounced than Hamilton had expected. For the Treasury Secretary, it was a stunning affirmation of confidence in the new government. Interest rates were tumbling, and faith in American credit was being restored. The exact contents of Hamilton's report remained a mystery until mid-January. When Congress convened, so-called jobbers, or wealthy dealers in securities, swarmed around Federal Hall and buttonholed members, trying to ferret out details of Hamilton's program. Speculators could reap huge profits if they divined Hamilton's intentions correctly, and at New York dinner parties they hung on his every word. Many rich merchants had already posted agents to backwoods areas of the South to scoop up depreciated state debt that would become more valuable if the federal government assumed the debt. Amid this atmosphere of contagious greed, Hamilton deflected attempts to pry loose information from him. In November, his Virginia friend Henry Lee wrote to inquire if Hamilton could divulge any information about his plan. Lee said that he hoped his request was not improper. In response, Hamilton was the very model of a scrupulous Treasury Secretary. "I am sure you are sincere when you say you would not subject me to an impropriety, nor do I know that there would be any in my answering your queries. But you remember the saying with regard to Caesar's wife, that she should be beyond suspicion. I think the spirit of it applicable to every man concerned in the administration of the finances of a country. With respect to the conduct of such men, suspicion is ever eagle-eyed, and the most innocent things are apt to be misinterpreted. On the eve of filing his report, Hamilton succumbed to jitters. "Tomorrow I open the budget, and you may imagine that today I am very busy and not a little anxious," he wrote to Angelica, who soon began to send him financial treatises from London bookshops. Skittish and high-strung, Hamilton knew that his proposals would spark frenzied debate and that legislative foes were sharpening their knives. When he informed Congress that he was ready to deliver his report, a controversy flared over whether he should do so in person or on paper. So great was the residual fear of executive encroachment on the legislature that Hamilton was not allowed to present his text in person, so the 51-page pamphlet was read aloud to the House of Representatives on January 14th. It was so lengthy that by the end, many representatives sat there in stupefied silence. Much later, Daniel Webster rhapsodized Hamilton's report as follows. "The fabled birth of Minerva from the brain of Jove was hardly more sudden or more perfect than the financial system of the United States as it burst forth from the conception of Alexander Hamilton." This was the long view of history and of many contemporaries, but detractors were immediately vocal. They were befuddled by the complexity of Hamilton's plan and its array of options for creditors. Opponents sensed that he was moving too fast on too many fronts for them to grasp all his intentions. He had devised his economic machinery so cunningly that its cogs and wheels meshed perfectly together. One could not tamper with the parts without destroying the whole. Hamilton later said of this ingenious structure, "Credit is an entire thing. Every part of it has the nicest sympathy with every other part. Wound one limb and the whole tree shrinks and decays." Perhaps the most settled prejudice Hamilton had to combat was a visceral sense that any program, even faintly resembling British practice, was pernicious. It was not just that a large funded debt seemed reminiscent of England's. It was also the fear that Hamilton was switching the power balance in government, tilting it from the House of Representatives, the people's branch, to the executive branch. Senator William McClay recorded his horror at Hamilton's program. "He recommends indiscriminate funding and, in the style of a British minister, has sent down his bill." Beyond this assertion of Treasury power, critics feared outright corruption of legislators by the executive. McClay and others suspected that several congressmen dabbled in government securities. "This villainous business," McClay concluded, "will damn the character of Hamilton as a minister forever." The myth of Alexander Hamilton as the American Mephistopheles was being born. McClay saw New York financiers as satanic henchmen in collusion with Hamilton to foster the most abandoned system of speculation ever broached in our country. Hamilton denied that congressmen were speculating in government securities. "As far as I know, there is not a member of the legislature who can properly be called a stock jobber or a paper dealer," he assured Washington. Of those who did own such securities, most had held them since the war, and Hamilton saw nothing wrong with this. It is a strange perversion of ideas that men should be deemed corrupt and criminal for becoming proprietors in the funds of their country. Yet I believe the number of members of Congress very small who have ever been considerably proprietors in the funds. McClay scoffed at such claims and saw Congress in an unholy league with New York speculators. "The whole town almost has been busy at it, and, of course, all engaged in influencing the measures of Congress. Nor have the members of Congress themselves kept their hands clean from this dirty work. Henceforth, we may consider speculation as a congressional employment." McClay was sincere in his misgivings and yet, like many of Hamilton's naysayers, basically ignorant of finance. When the sinking fund began buying up government debt later in the year, McClay decried a plot to line the pockets of speculators. He did not seem to realize that such market operations reduced debt and drove down interest rates, benefiting the entire economy. McClay and other critics were correct that the Hamiltonian system did not necessarily reward the just or the virtuous, yet they missed the larger social benefits that accrued to society. Hamilton's report on public credit had an electrifying effect. Securities began to change hands with a speed never before seen in America. Robert R. Livingston observed that the speculative craze invaded all ranks of people, even infecting hardened anti-federalists such as George Clinton and Melancton Smith. Staggered by this rampant speculation, Congressman James Jackson dubbed the perpetrators rapacious wolves seeking whom they may devour. Jackson stood up on the House floor in late January to protest the spirit of havoc, speculation, and ruin that had followed Hamilton's report, and charged that many speculators had profited from advance knowledge of it. He alleged that three vessels loaded with speculators had departed from New York within the past fortnight, bound for the South to sweep up state debt from unsuspecting investors who had not yet heard about Hamilton's program. "My soul arises indignant at the avaricious and immoral turpitude which so vile a conduct displays," he thundered. Another critic, Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia, exhibited the often untutored indignation that greeted Hamilton's plan. End of Disc 12.